Welcome to the Barcast, bringing you guests from Wall Street, Washington, and across the world to shine a light on the ever-changing economic and financial landscape. This week, we're bringing you a special bonus episode on the debt ceiling crisis. Recorded on a live webinar on May 8th, here's your host, Michael Barr.
Rather than bore you all with just listening to me, two great friends I've recruited to join us to help out, Michael Puglisi, joining us for the first time, and I certainly hope Michael not for the last, is a director and senior economist with Wells Fargo, their investment bank. He's based in New York. He covers the economy with a primary focus on the labor markets, inflation, monetary policy, and fiscal policy on the debt ceiling itself. Dan Mahaffey, of course, is the policy director at the Washington think tank for the Center of the Study of the Presidency and Congress. It is a bipartisan or nonpartisan think tank. The founder of the Center for the Study was a man named David Abshire. He was an ambassador. He was senior advisor to Reagan. And he wrote a wonderful book that I think should resonate. And he called for a return. This was 10, 15 years ago, a return of civility to government. What a great message from my friend, the late David Abshire, whom I still miss a great deal. A return for civility. I think civility is going to be very important to this debt ceiling discussion, and I'm afraid it will be in short supply, but we're going to get into that. I'm going to show you a couple of slides here. I want to start by telling you that this debt ceiling began, the nation first had one in 1917. And the reason Congress enacted a debt ceiling was because they kept having to pass these spending bills for World War I. And they kept having to come back and have more votes. And so finally they said, okay, we're going to authorize spending of this much money, but don't go crazy. So here's the limit. It has been a perennial political football. As we have looked at these events in Washington and around the world that have been major events, markets and investors have said, oh boy, if that happens, the sky's going to fall. Stock prices are going to fall. No one was expecting 9/11, but if we look from June 15th to 2001 on to 2002, you can see the dip there on 9/11. Markets shut down, drop in equity prices. They recovered very quickly. 2002 was a completely different topic. S&P 500 and the two-year treasury over the summer of 2011. This was during the last debt crisis. And we thought that the S&P 500 would crash and that the two-year treasury yield would go straight through the roof because nobody wanted to buy our debt because the S&P downgraded our debt. And look what happened. The debt didn't move. The yields didn't move. So the yields stayed very low. And the stock market actually rallied once we got past the uncertainty of the problem. So the uncertainty of the problem over and over again continues to present opportunity. We faced the same thing prior to the Iraq invasion after 9/11, same thing. Everybody expected markets to really get shaken up. Stock markets rallied, bond market rallied. Everything was fine once we get past that critical period of uncertainty. This has always been a political football, always been a political football. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to start with Michael and then ask go to talk with Dan. Michael, as we cover some of the facts around what this debt ceiling means, how much time do we have, what it looks like, what does it mean economically? These are his areas of expertise. I'm going to give you one quotation, though, before we start. A senator in 2006 on the floor of the Senate said he refused, absolutely refused, to approve a debt limit increase. As requested by President Bush, 43, without a plan to reduce the budget deficit, said it was absolutely irresponsible. The senator was Barack Obama. opposing Bush. He says that it was a political comment, and he says it was, you know, probably one he wished he hadn't made. My point is, I've no shot at President Obama or then Senator Obama at all. Rather, this has always been a football of political opportunity. The consequences of this particular political game are much higher than I think even members of Congress and the Senate understand. And that's the problem. They don't understand the consequences. And this group, who made us go to 16 votes to confirm a Speaker of the House, more than any other group, I think threaten a real shutdown on a voting process that otherwise seems entirely logical. Michael, tell me what you're seeing with the debt ceiling, what you think it means economically, and what do you think about this debate?
Yeah, well, thanks, Michael, and thanks to everyone for having me on today. So it's a really tough topic. The debt limit is one that I think really throws everyone for a loop. When I talk to investors across Wall Street all the time, it's just really hard to grapple with because it's such a political lens and it's bringing the risk-free rate into question, right? I talk to the many, many investors across the Treasury market on a day-to-day basis. And the problem is when there's any side of trouble, right? It doesn't matter if it's a pandemic, if it's a housing crisis, if you name it, the sort of playbook is you pile into some type of safe asset and where better to go than Treasury securities,
right?
Particularly shorter dated Treasury securities, right? Very little interest rate risk, as we've all learned in the past few months, interest rate risk can be just as dangerous as credit risk sometimes. And so that's where the play is. But of course, in a debt ceiling environment, that gets flipped on its head. In terms of what I'm saying, just from an ex-date standpoint, I think the early June period should very seriously be treated as an ex-date. I think folks sometimes think about the ex-date a little incorrectly, where they think about
it. What do you mean by ex-date?
Sorry, yeah. So the ex-date, meaning the date we go over the cliff, if you will, the date on which Treasury's exhausted all the accounting maneuvers, all the cash on hand, tax revenues coming in, can't pay the bills anymore. You know, that's the date where you owe $100 that day and there's only 97 bucks left in the piggy bank, if you will.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, you look at that early June period and it's a probability. We don't know for sure the exact day they'll run out of money. But if it's 15%, 20%, 25% chance it's in early June, I think that's high enough. You need to have some discomfort, right? The last thing Treasury wants, the last thing anyone wants is for them to run out of money one day and find out unexpectedly. So I think that that risk needs to be treated very seriously right now, that early June is on the table as when the rubber hits the road.
And okay, so rubber hits the road, and I'm seeing Secretary Yellen's on CNBC right now as we speak, saying she says there's really no good option out there. They're trying to find maybe the least bad option. Certainly raising the debt limit is one of those, is somehow just doing it doesn't seem to look like it's gonna happen. So I'm gonna come back to you in just a second and ask about the real timing, Michael. So we get to this X date, and then we go into the maneuvers of Janet Yellen and the Treasury Department and how much runway we have left. And is there a threat at that point, Michael, is there a threat at that point that the debt gets downgraded again? The US debt, it got downgraded to AA last time we did this in 2011.
Yeah, there's a threat. I think you would have to go over the cliff, if you will. The rating agencies, at least my impression and read of them, is that the bar is high for a downgrade. So if you get another run-of-the-mill type political showdown here, I don't think you'd see a downgrade. But if there was an actual missed payment, even if it was not on Treasuries, even if it was a missed payment to a military contractor or to a Social Security beneficiary or whoever, right? Some creditor of the government. I think you probably would see a downgrade then and probably a lot worse than that as well.
Is this kind of a debate appropriate? Why do we keep coming back to it, Michael, if it presents such a serious economic threat?
Because I think the serious economic threat is what gives it leverage, right? It has to be increased every so often. This is nothing new. You just raised a quote from pushing 20 years ago where it was being used as a political cudgel, right? And I think in a period like this where legislation only moves so often in any given session, particularly in divided government, particularly when it's often tied to the annual appropriation bills or the debt ceiling or both, There's a leverage point here, right? To try to achieve something, whatever that something is. It's different every time we go through this debt ceiling exercise, raising caps, instituting budget caps, border wall things, right? The argument is always different. But because it's serious, it creates, I think, a leverage point for someone somewhere in the system to try to utilize it.
I'm going to go to Dan now, but when I come back, Michael, I'm going to ask you, do we have too much debt? $31.4 trillion.
Yeah.
That's 118% of GDP. That's been problematic in the past. Dan, tell me what you're seeing in Washington. There's a big meeting tomorrow with President Biden and the Senate and congressional leadership to try and get something done. What are the odds there? What are you hearing? And how does this play out from on Capitol Hill?
Look, thank you both to both of you and to our audience. Thank you. Thank you, Michaels, for your thoughts so far. We hashed over some of this in our podcast last week. We talked about it like the stages of death and dying. We're in the denial and anger phase. The idea that a clean debt ceiling can go through once the Republicans pass their bill in the House, it's denial to think that you can do that. What we've heard over the weekend is the anger, the hardening of positions, the comments on the Sunday shows, some of the pessimism, each side trying to stake out their position before these talks tomorrow and really make sure that their sides, the proverbial wagons are all circled before these talks. Going ahead, though, we've got to get to the bargaining and acceptance. If you go on to have some kind of discussion based on what the Republicans have. You're starting to hear some other things that could be thrown in as part of a deal. Permitting reform, probably the lowest hanging fruit. Other things, though, like maybe lowering some of these spending caps. Ultimately, though, the challenge at the end of this is the acceptance, and that is McCarthy getting it through the Republican House and getting these conservatives, some of whom see default as a healthy thing, some of the purely radicals, that they need to get that through the House, get that agreement through, and that'll be the challenge. And now I think what some of the Republicans we've seen start to do in advance of these negotiations are shift some of the goalposts back. What are the things that a compromise deal could look like? Or what are the break glass options of how could you extend it for 2 weeks, a month, if it looked like we were getting some progress in a negotiation, but needed to buy ourselves more time? All this we have to remember, there's 12 working days left on the legislative calendar this month. So any of
wait, 12 days. That means Congress is in Washington for only 12 more days in the month of May?
Correct.
And I heard that President Biden is only going to be in town for 6 of those 12 days.
Look, yes, President Biden does have both a G7 summit in Japan and a Quad Leaders Summit in Sydney planned for this month. So look, this does complicate the calendar and the scheduling. But obviously, we've seen those plans change in times of crisis before. So I would expect that would be no different if both sides need to stay or perhaps Vice President Harris has to go abroad.
Okay. All right. Dan, there's something I want to just before we get been referred to as the nuclear option. Section 4 of the 14th Amendment declaring that the debt ceiling could be unconstitutional. President Biden was asked about it, and he said, I've not gotten there yet.
And I, right.
I've not gotten there yet. Really, Mr.
You know, heaven help us that this is not just a political and economic discussion. Now we have to make it a legal one. The 14th Amendment argument of this, I think the challenge becomes once you make it a legal question, you have to have that first missed payment to create standing for U.S. debt. So that argument, and I think why they want to shy away from it, is markets aren't going to sit around and wait for the courts to parse this out. Or let it exist as some sort of pseudo default right. While we wait to answer that.
Okay, Michael, come on back in with me now. You've heard what Dan had to say. Tell us what you think.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I get asked all the time about all these break the glass options, right? Treasury prioritizing principal and interest payments.
$1 trillion coin. Yeah.
$1 trillion coin, unilateral action by the president, the Fed buying defaulted treasury securities. I mean, just the list goes on and on. And sure, they're interesting. There are probably some advantages to some of them, but ultimately none of them really solve the problem that I think Dan just spoke to so well, which is that in the interim, right, you can still have economic and financial market pain and potentially quite serious. Sure, you prioritize interest and principal, but someone somewhere is still getting shortchanged and potentially to a sizable amount. And will markets even care, right? You can argue you've technically avoided a default, but you know, I don't know if markets in that kind of environment are going to be interested in those nuances or interested in the nuances of a protracted and uncertain Supreme Court hearing, or again, all of these different factors. So, you know, maybe in an absolute pinch, could it buy you hours or a few days, maybe, but I'm just very skeptical that that's any sort of medium to longer term solution. All roads eventually lead back to some type of longer term solution, which is increasing or suspending the debt ceiling to me. I'm very skeptical anything else can play out other than that.
118% debt to GDP right now. How much debt is too much debt for the United States? Because I have clients who ask, look, the interest on that debt and interest rates going up are going to kill the American budget. And it looks like after what we just saw here in April, tax receipts aren't solving enough of the problem.
Yeah. The honest answer is no one knows how much debt is too much debt. And I think that's good news and bad news, honestly. It's very easy to get lost in the numbers of the federal debt, right? $31 trillion of debt sounds enormous. 118% of GDP sounds really big. But also the U.S. economy is enormous, right? It's $24, $25 trillion a year. It means over a decade, you're talking about a quarter to a third of a $250 trillion of U.S. GDP. What makes me nervous is not necessarily the size of the debt so much as just the open-ended structural budget deficits. I think that the debt level is very manageable at current levels, even with current interest rates. What worries me is just an unwillingness to bring it into sort of any kind of reasonable longer-term stability over the next 10 or 20 or 30 years. I mean, if you told me at current debt we could run 2 or 3%, you know, budget deficits over the next 10 or 20 years, realized however you want, a mix of tax increases, right, spending cuts, both, right? You pick your policy prescription. I wouldn't be that worried about the current size of the debt. But if you tell me we're going to have interest rates that go up and up and up and policymakers that are totally unwilling to make those hard choices, then yeah, I feel a little bit more concerned about what that means over the medium to longer run for sure.
Okay. Dan, let's just think about this meeting. If somehow Kevin McCarthy and the Republican folks can agree with the Democrats and the president to some sort of accommodation, and McCarthy looks up at the president and says, I don't have the Republican votes. I'm not going to get past the row of no on this compromise. I'm not. So you go find the Democratic votes who are going to cross over and vote for this thing. If that were to happen, what happens to Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House when he gets back and faces those five guys who are now outraged that he went around them?
So first, let's go into those negotiations in that room. Borrow from the last weekend the metaphor of those horses at the Churchill Downs. They need to have their blinders on and focus on the debt ceiling, because these other issues that we're also going to have.
You're saying the politicians should have political blinders on? What?
Well, during this negotiation, they're going to have to make sure that the Title 42, the immigration stuff, the gun control, a lot of the other stuff that's moving on the Hill right now needs to be set aside from this. Okay. So that's going to be, I think, the first key challenge is to stay focused.
Can they do that, Dan? Will they be able to do that?
I'll be pretty surprised if they do, but I think the seriousness of this is something that will keep it more focused, even though we will have to tune out the peanut gallery, as it were, that will try and add more to this. That said, when you do get to that question of what McCarthy does when he has to deliver something, one has been always the question, could you say that McCarthy is fine if he delivers something with a majority of the Republican conference? However, the rules that they put in place would allow any one member to go back and challenge his speakership. So again, that matter of how you go back, that motion to vacate the chair, How do you do that in a way that, you know, avoids, again, going back to that perhaps 15, 20 vote night, looking for a new speaker? Because the question is, if not Kevin McCarthy, who? There's no alternative waiting in the wings if this doesn't go through. So I don't see the person also standing there waiting to knife him, as it were, and complicate this further.
But what you are saying is that if somehow there was some grand bargain ultimately made for that could circumvent 5 or 6 no votes, his speakership would seriously be at risk, though.
It would be. He would have to decide whether he delivers this deal at the threat of his speakership being imperiled. And that's why I think you see a lot of his allies trying to temper expectations and explaining that a lot of the things they could still get would be significant conservative wins.
I'm hearing two other things in Washington. One is they're going to kick the can down the road until the end of the fiscal year, make it a part of next year budget negotiations. We're going to be dealing with this in September, and it's going to be just a bigger mess with more complicated issues. Or they're going to vote it out another year or so and a kick the can down the road thing. Anytime somebody tells me kick the can down the road in Washington, it always rings true, doesn't it? I mean, yeah, that seems to be the easiest thing with that fewer political consequences. Dan, what are the odds there? And Michael, what do you think? How do you think markets would react to that if that happens?
Look, I think that's usually what we see as the model for solving these things in periods of divided government. There's no spirit of grand bargain left in Washington anymore. So the kick the can does become the solution. The concern I have, though, is that there's not as many Republicans in this current caucus who have the experience of past deals that kick the can down the road. They're truly the apotheosis of the Tea Party and MAGA movements that might not be willing to make such a deal and see the leverage lost by these kick the can down the road things is no longer being worth it anymore.
Yeah, I just love anyone who can use the word apotheosis. Okay, Michael.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think I don't have the vocabulary to match apotheosis. So, but no, I agree with what you said, Dan. And what I would just add from the market standpoint is kicking it a few months, I don't think matters much one way or the other. Markets will just sort of hit snooze on the alarm and come back to it whenever the deadline gets a lot closer again. You know, if you punted it a year, I don't think you'd see any immediate market reaction, but the last thing markets want is this fight to happen again 12 months from now in the middle of a presidential election year. I don't think that that's something anybody wants to see in the summer of 2024 when we're, you know, hitting the peak of conventions and everything else like that. So maybe, you know, punting it makes sense to September or thereabouts from a fiscal standpoint and a budget standpoint. But I think markets should certainly hope that whatever the end solution is, it carries you through November 2024.
Here's where all of my reading keeps kind of coming down. This could get really ugly, We could get to the brink of default. Even if somehow the unthinkable does happen to default, it will be very, very short-lived, that folks will come to their senses. They'll get on the other side of it. They'll pass what they need to pass. And this is, the U.S. isn't going to default on its debt. So 2 years from now, this is in the rearview mirror. Maybe 6 months from now, God willing, or 12 months from now, we're in the rearview mirror. We move on with the business of the republic, and the economy continues to take the direction. This seems like it's going to have certain pressures for the Fed, particularly at a time when we're looking at pressures from a banking industry that's having some tightening and credit tightening there. But basically, what I'm hearing is wisdom accepted is we get through it, could get very ugly, but this will pass. Michael and Dan, do you agree with that?
I think I agree with it. The only thing I would add is that it brings me to mind a John Maynard Keynes quote, right? In the long run, we're all dead. I mean, yeah, eventually things will be okay. The question is how much collateral damage is going to be done between now and eventually. Even if there is only a short-lived default and a while from now things get better, you can still endure a lot of pain, right? An economy that's already teetering and has challenges at the moment, is that enough to tip us into recession? if we do default, and even if payments are only missed for a few days or a week or something like that? Do investors start demanding additional compensation on a go-forward basis? Is that right. going to cost the government, you know, more interest costs, even higher spending on the national debt on a go-forward basis? What are those implications? You know, what does this mean from a credit crunch standpoint when banks are already thinking about pulling back from a lending standpoint, issuers that may not want to issue debt into that and build another factory? So eventually, I 100% agree with you, things will look better, but I think you'd still want to worry about the collateral damage done there, both to financial markets and the real economy, if there was even just a short-lived default.
Chief Economist Jay Bryson and your group still looking for some sort of mild recession coming in the future here. It's always 6 months away, isn't it? But you still expect some sort of contraction there. Dan, what do you say? We get past this?
I think we do, but the question is, what is the damage? We talked about the economic damage. How long do we all pay, for lack of a better term, the stupid tax put on us by the politicians? But also beyond that, what is the questions about American financial power, global leadership? They're all part of this too. At a time when Beijing, Moscow, India, others look to alternatives for the dollar, all of this is just another signal and a broader question of, can the American system manage itself and uphold a key pillar of American strength?
Michael, you know, there's a question for you. We've gotten a couple of questions. One is, do we think money markets are going to be safe? Yes, is certainly my answer. Money markets will be safe. There, you get to these periods where crazy things starts happening with bond prices, and you can see money markets shaken. They've been shaken before, but I don't see that as a real risk. One question says that collateral damage, how deep could this panic drive markets? I showed from my chart earlier, we actually get the opposite once we get through these things. Michael, have you all done any work there?
Yeah. So, I mean, what I would just say is, you know, money markets are always the safe place to go when the world is ending. But here, too, is where the debt ceiling gets so topsy-turvy. What are money market funds, particularly government money market funds, invested in? Treasury securities, they're the very topic of what we're worried about from a default standpoint. And what are they invested in specifically? Short-dated treasury securities, things that come due over the next handful of months. And so, you know, is that a cause for panic? Of course not. But it's, again, when I talk to some of our clients, it's why I think many folks struggle to get their head around the debt ceiling, because it's the normal playbook can run a little bit counter to what you might have in a run-of-the-mill recession, right? Like we were talking about previously. And from a market standpoint, the real problem is we've never actually had a default, right? We can talk about 2011 or 2013 or other periods, but all of those, an 11th hour resolution was reached. They eventually, yes, even if it was a day before the X date was going to be crossed, they did increase it or suspend it. We're sort of venturing into the abyss if you actually crossed that. And maybe it would be overblown. Maybe it would be a lot more serious than folks realize. But it's that uncertainty that I think really should give folks pause.
I think it's giving a lot of folks pause. I'm not sure it's giving the right folks pause. I wish members of Congress were having a little bit more pause over this. You mentioned John Maynard Keynes' quotation. I'm going to go back to Winston Churchill's. You can count on the Americans to do the right thing every time after they've tried everything else. It sure seems like we might be trying it and proving Mr. Churchill right once again. Folks, all of our listeners, Michael Puglisi from Wells Fargo Advisors, senior economist Dan Mahaffey, director of Policy Center for the Study of the Presidency in Congress, thank you for joining us. Thank you for helping all of us at Hightower get a little bit smarter today. If you want to follow up with any questions, members of our audience, let me know and I'll send some emails out. We hope it's been helpful. We'll be back soon. Bye.
Thanks for joining us on this special edition of the Farcast. And thanks to Michael's guest, Dan Mahaffey, and from Wells Fargo, Michael Puglisi. The Farcast comes to you weekly and is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. We would like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. The information, statements, comments, views, and opinions expressed and provided in the podcast, including by speakers who are not officers, employees, or agents of Hightower Advisors or Farr, Miller & Washington, are not necessarily those of Hightower Advisors, Carr Miller in Washington, or any firm any of our guests may represent. Any mention of a specific security should not be considered as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any security, index fund manager, or strategy. We strongly recommend you review with a financial professional before you make any investment decision. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. Go beyond the headlines each week with the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farr Miller in Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties, expressed or implied, as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates assume no liability or any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.